Welcome to the 142nd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 20 years to the day that Australia beat England at Trent Bridge to win their seventh straight Ashes series. Welcome to the podcast that remembers wondering if England would ever win it again.
And given England's performance against India overnight, you wonder whether England will ever win a test match full stop again. In this episode of Reverse Threat Radio, Andy is going to be our man on the ground, giving us, cutting through the hyperbole about the 100 and giving us the on-the-ground view of what it's actually like at a game. He's also going to be telling us about the curiously named Vigoro. You'll find out whether that's a male enhancement pill or something to do with sport later on. And we're going to be reviewing Spinwash 93, a Sky Sports documentary that I have to say I enjoyed more than I thought I would. Now, Andy, it's the summer of freedom in the UK, and if one thing says summer of freedom, it's the 100. Tell us about your trip.
So on Monday night, I saw the Oval Invincibles just about live up to their name against the Welsh Fire. And it was a decent enough game. And I think, as you say, after the last year, any live cricket at this stage is a joy. I think for all the hypes and the new rules, it had the feel of a 2020. And in particular, some of the innovations, for example, only changing ends after 10 balls, it didn't, to me, massively shift the tempo of the game. I think part of that is due to the fact that even though a bowler could ball 10 balls straight, they tended to just do five and then change, which slowed things down anyway.
Why do you think that is? Did you see noticeably bowlers getting a bit weary after five balls? Or do you think it's just that that's how, you know, is it a pattern that's carried on from the over structure from before? Because it's interesting when you try and break up some of those, you know, someone who's only ever bowled six balls and then suddenly saying, oh, you can bowl 10. How many people are actually going to say, yeah, sure, I'll do it?
So I confess, I have not watched nearly enough of the 100 as a whole to see whether most teams are kind of playing it safe on this or changing it up. I think I did see at least once on Monday night where a bowler bowled through their 10 because their first five had clearly gone really well and taking them off would feel like an odd decision. My personal memory of the night will be a Will Jacks flicked six, which was just wonderful. How on earth you get that amount of power on your wrists to send something into the crowd, deep into the back of the crowd like that. In terms of the big question, I guess, is this a success? I know there'll be a lot of ECB folk eagerly trying to analyse whether this new audience they are looking so hard for has actually turned up. My experience on the basis of one evening is clearly very anecdotal, but I fear they may be disappointed. This felt like a classic Oval T20 crowd, overwhelmingly men in their 20s and 30s, and it was a lot more boozy than family friendly. And I think this does pose a challenge to the organisers. You know, how do you create an environment that is what the hardcore, I suppose, want, but is also welcoming to newcomers?
Would you go again?
I'm kind of at a stage generally where I don't rush to T20 games anymore. I will go if friends want to go and it's a nice sort of sociable thing, but without wanting to be too much of a cricket snob, I'd always much rather go for a day of the long form stuff. So would I go again? I would go if asked by people I would like to spend an evening drinking a
pleasant
beer with.
That is the diplomat's. That is the diplomat's answer. But again, you're probably not the the target audience around this.
Well, I'm not, and this is sort of the thing we keep coming back to. And you know, many people other than us have gone into far more detail, so we won't try and repeat these debates about, you know, potential harm to the broader county game. Could you have done this via the 2020 blast? But I guess what I would say is this isn't intended for us. This is intended to get new people into the game. I'm just not quite sure I was seeing them on Monday night.
I am curious, just by the way, to see the what the PR spin is. If, you know, the Oval Invincibles come up with a string of losses, quite how they're going to, you know, massage that compared to the statement that they've made with their name. But we'll see.
It's a name set up. I often think this with some of the IPL names, when a team that sounds sort of unconquerable, like the Royals or whatever, just spends their time losing it can sound a bit dismal. You've been taking an interest particularly in this issue of language and the 100.
Yeah, so, you know, in lockdown Sydney, my experience of the 100 isn't sadly swilling beer with you in the stands. It's kind of watching on from a distance. And I've been reading a number of interesting pieces. It is, you know, as we've discussed on this podcast, something that's attracted a great deal of vitriol. But there was quite an interesting piece, I thought, which was, I think it was in The Telegraph, which was a piece about how Sky was instructing their commentators to cover the cricket, and it raises some really interesting questions about language and audience. So Sky had said that words such as googly and yorker shouldn't be used, and fair enough, because they are words with very specific meanings that, unless you're initiated into the cult of cricket, you probably don't know about. And you know, the 100, if the 100 is aimed towards new audiences, then you can't really use those kinds of words. I thought what was more interesting was the fact that there was actually a change to the way that, you know, the scoring was expressed. So the first innings was all about talking about the number of runs scored and the number of balls faced. The second innings was all about talking about the number of runs needed and the number of balls left. So you wouldn't be saying 14 for two anymore. You'd be saying the Oval Invincibles had scored 14 off seven balls, or the, you know, Welsh Fire Dragons, or whatever they're called, required, you know, 37 off 16 balls, and wickets kind of become irrelevant. And I think what's interesting about this is that the change of language really does signal the fundamental shift in the structure of the game, compared to even something like a one-day international, where you can't get a true reflection of the game without at any point knowing how many wickets have fallen. And in this point of the game, in this form of the game, it probably matters a whole lot less, because kind of anyone can come out and hit a six to win if they really need to. And I think it's interesting to see that through this language, I think what we're seeing is the fact that you know, we can't have the same language describing the 100 as we can ODIs or even T20s, and that there is a fundamental difference between the two games in that sense.
There's clearly an argument around something like, for example, the term yorker. Do you not use it, or do you use it and explain it? Because I think there's a part of me that thinks, well, why not? You know, part of the beauty of the sport is in its language. Having said that, I don't mind, for example, you know, there's been criticism by some fans about, you know, talking about batters out rather than wickets and things like this. Even as a lover of the sport, wicket is a deeply unhelpful term for people trying to understand the game.
Because it means so many different things.
So yeah, I have to say, I don't mind that attempt to try to make it a little bit more comprehensible.
Yeah. One thing I did wonder while this was going on is what the great John Woodcock, ex-editor of Wisden, cricket writer, cricket editor, I think, of the Times for a long time, would have made of it. John Woodcock died since we last recorded, at the grand old age of 90-something, 93, I think. So much that could be said about him, but just briefly in tribute, wanted to share two astonishing facts that I discovered. One astonishing, one humorous, that I discovered since his death. One of which is, and it took, I'm still kind of puzzling over this, is that John Woodcock died 3 weeks ago. His grandfather was born before the Battle of Waterloo. And the Battle of Waterloo was, I mean, I'm no historian, it was kind of 1816 or something.
1815, yeah.
1815. Anyway, so there you go. Puzzle that one out. You know, he had an extraordinary life, John Woodcock, throughout the 20th century, starting off with a very traumatic injury as a child, and then, you know, kind of getting picked up as a cricket writer by E.W. Swanton. The other thing that I kind of loved about him was the fact that he called his dogs after cricketing terms probably now banned from the 100. Gully and Stumper apparently were his two faithful hounds. From the archives. Now, cricket has spawned a few variations over the course of its history. One of them, some people may say, is the 100, as we've just been discussing. Another of them is less known, or at least forgotten nowadays, and it's a game called Vigoro. And Andy's going to be telling us a little bit about this strange hybrid.
At first sight, it looks a lot like a cricket match, but soon you start to notice differences. The pitch is a little shorter than usual. There are six stumps rather than three. And hang on a sec, everyone is holding tennis rackets. We're at the start of the 20th century and we're at a game of Vigoro. It was the invention of a travelling salesman, John George Grant. Several articles describe him as an Englishman, but elsewhere this is confusingly described as a Canadian invention, so I'm not entirely sure on that.
Maybe it's kind of disassociation, not wanting it to be English, you know, this idea that it could only be a foreigner that could, you know, a foreign invention that could bastardise our game in this way.
Yes, yeah, no one quite wanted to claim the credit / responsibility. A very simple idea, which was to combine cricket and tennis. Every player has a racket. You bowl by serving, which is actually quite fun, and you take a catch by deflecting the ball into the air and then bringing it to rest on your racket.
Oh, that'd be tricky.
Extremely tricky. Other than that, normal cricket rules applied. So, you know, as far as I understood, through to LBW, for example.
So, when you talk about seeing this, seeing the game, are there photos of this? Are there paintings of this? Are there a kind of accounts of contemporary sort of Vigoro games?
Good question. I've not seen a photo of an early 20th century game. As we'll get to later, that you can still find it played in some form today, but most of what I've been able to find are drawings, which are I think often involve Grant's own handiwork, making it look, you know, very dynamic and exciting.
Yeah.
His motive, and I think this comes back to your point at the start about the new formats of cricket, you know, something like the 100. This was driven by finance. Grant believed that with the popularity of both sports, there would be a ready-made audience for his new creation. He felt part of the appeal would be in its greater pace. Bowling took place at only one end and batsmen had to run if they hit it. So again, you can see a lot of comparisons here with 2020 and the 100. This is about quickening the game up. What was it actually like to play? Well, I go to a source that we haven't used frequently on this podcast, the Whanganui Chronicle from New Zealand. In 1901 said that the game requires less exertion than cricket and supplies considerably more excitement than tennis. It is rather scathing on tennis.
Yes.
Now, it was played with a rubber ball. I should have made this clear, rather than a cricket ball, which you may have worked out, given that a cricket ball on a racket would have probably ended badly. And the pace at which this rubber ball could be served and the need to defend six stumps rather than three very much made this not a batsman's game. Scores were low. It may also not come as a surprise to hear that given the racket skill involved, tennis players tended to dominate. So we have a game at Lord's in 1902 where a team led by tennis star E.H. Miles thrashed a team of cricketers led by England batsman Bobby Abel. The Yorkshire Post, which I think it says something about the attention that Vigoro got, at least in the short term, turned up to report on the game at Lord's, and they noted that it requires special skill to catch or check with a racket a fast-driven ball, which I think you could see that is an impressive thing to pull off, to reach out a racket and stop the ball and then catch it.
And knock it up and then, yeah, kind of bring it to... bring it under control. I think there is that interesting question of what it says about the sort of skill set of cricket versus the skill set of tennis, because we don't really think of them as comparable sports in many ways, other than the fact that they both involve using some kind of blunt object to hit a ball. And I don't know, I would necessarily have said, you know, if you put a team of cricketers and a team of tennis players playing this game together, which one would be, you know, kind of... better off at it. But interesting that the tennis players seem so much to kind of dominate.
I suppose it really is the racket skill, isn't it? The cricketers, for all their ability, were not used to using a racket in the same way. But the
kind of variation that you use it in tennis, you know, the kind of soft hands and hard hands and all of that, yeah.
I think really interesting to note that both Lord's and the Queen's Club were willing to host games of Vigoro. And it seems a tad surprising, given they could have seen this new sport as a rival. Instead, I think in keeping with Grant's philosophy, they saw it commercially. This was a chance to sell some more tickets. You know, you can't play tennis perhaps every constant at Queen's Club. This is a chance to do something new. And they clearly never saw it as a competitor. And I think that turned out to be a pretty fair assessment, because within 6 years of its creation, the novelty had very much started to wear off. Grant responded to that by trying to simplify the rules. So instead of a racket, he introduced a round bottomed wooden bat. If you look at the drawings, it looks a bit like a wooden paddle. And we go back to normal cricket bowling. The problem with this, as far as I can see it, is I'm just not sure at this stage why you wouldn't just play cricket. You know, once you're at the point where you've got something that is not a bat but is a wooden stick, people are bowling as normal. I'm just not sure that it's far enough away from cricket to be a meaningful alternative.
I wonder whether it also says something about the what it is that crowds come to, spectators come to watch sports people do, which is be excellent at what they do. And that if this ended up being this kind of hybrid game, which, as you're saying, was really tricky, that people would end up, you know, really skilled cricket players and really skilled tennis players would have been mediocre Virago players kind of at best, and that maybe that's just a less thrilling proposition than actually seeing people be really, really good at what they do. And maybe that says something about why we watch certain sports.
I guess there's also something in it about just the appetite for sport that individual fans have. I mean, we know that that is considerable. That, you know, you only have to look at the cricket calendar to see the appetite for watching live cricket. But at the same time, if you are a fervent cricket fan or a fervent tennis fan, perhaps you couldn't really see where that hybrid fitted into your life. Why did you need it when you were very much enjoying your own sport? Grant never gave up. He took the game to Australia, where it did gain some popularity among women working in munitions factory during the First World War, and he was still trying to promote the game up to his death in 1927. I was astonished to find out that it does still exist today, although it is a very niche sport. This was brought home to me through my internet research, where any attempt to Google Vigoro tries to take you to Vigoro's branded lawn products.
Right.
As far as I can see, it seems to be a women's only sport played only in Australia now. But it's interesting that for all the challenges of getting the game to land and establish itself, there was enough in it for it to keep going. So while it may not have lived up to Grant's prediction that it was destined to be the greatest game, survival of it in some form does feel like an achievement in itself. To the review, and this episode we've been watching Spinwash 93. This is a Sky Sports documentary on India's 3-0 test whitewash of England in 1993. It's hot off the press, published in June this year. Michael Atherton is our narrator, and we benefit from lots of previously unseen handheld camera footage taken by Dermot Reeve. Both Atherton and Reeve were in the touring party. It's 3 episodes, each about 20 minutes long. Do you reckon that's enough to tell this story?
I suppose the question is always, you know, what to include and what to leave out. And certainly around this tour, there is so much going on. There's the, you know, MCC decide to mount a rebellion against the selectors about David Gower and Jack Russell being left out. There's the state. There's a story around Indian cricket. You know, the points made at the beginning that Indian cricket at this time is not what we think of today. It's impecunious. The team's not successful. There's a single, you know, no one's vying for broadcast rights because the state broadcaster gets rights for everything. And then at the center of it, we have a test series, and all of these things are kind of, I suppose, glanced at in a way, but the real focus, the kind of singular focus of this, is what was it like for the England players on the ground during this tour. And actually taking that singular focus, I think, really, really benefits it, not trying to tell the wider context of the tour as well.
And it's a film built on serendipity, really, because, and we never really get an explanation for why he does it, but Dermot Reeve, who didn't play in any of the test matches but was on the touring party, does a very fine job as amateur cameraman. And he does have that great thing where he can catch players at ease in a way that only a fellow teammate can. I kept finding myself comparing this to the test, which we reviewed a few episodes ago. And I thought that while I very much enjoyed the test, I thought this was tight in a way that the test was a bit bloated. And I also felt that there is a difference when you've got a fellow teammate behind the camera and there's a sort of relaxation there. It's a very English experience, isn't it? I think one thing in terms of your point about what's in and what's out, we don't see much of the Indian experience.
No, we don't see much. There are times when I would have been interested, you know, particularly when there's a lot of, you know, talk about the difficulties that the England team are coming up against into, you know, kind of cricketing difficulties, actually to hear a bit more from the, you know, likes of a very young, fresh-faced Sachin Tendulkar, who appears in this series at about the age of sort of 16. We get a very, very short and slightly inane interview between Dermot Reeve and Sachin Tendulkar, which Tendulkar kind of refuses to say anything. I think the other thing that is the difference from the test, one of which is the kind of honesty of the footage, although I'm sure there's a lot of more honest stuff that hit the cutting room floor out of Dermot Reeve's archive. The other thing I think that's really helpful here is the passage of time. Whereas with the test, this is stuff that's in, you know, a lot of the players are still playing. It was, you know, covering events 2 or 3 years before it was released. This is covering events 30 years, yeah. Yeah, 30 years. Gosh, time flies. 30 years after they actually happened. And I think that allows a lot of the players to have a kind of quite honest perspective on these things. So as well as the footage of Dermot Reeve's footage and some kind of, you know, TV footage from the time, there is overlaid a series of interviews with the players kind of now looking back. And you do therefore get some wonderful moments, you know, from the likes of Mike Gatting and Graham Gooch and Phil Tufnell. You get some moments where they are very honest about their performances and what the experience of being on that tour was like. And I think that's one of the things that makes this so compelling.
And they speak of it with a lot of fondness. I mean, it's interesting. They clearly went around the Sky team getting these people to speak about it, and that they were happy to do so. As a very small aside, I really like this thing of getting the interviews done over archive footage rather than footage of the talking head, which I think is increasingly quite tired in documentaries. If it's about anything, it's about the fun of touring. And I think more and more, and I guess this is particularly in the context of the last year where, you know, COVID restrictions have made touring a real you know, challenge and trial for teams. This is touring as something to be enjoyed rather than just as a professional commitment. Yes. England get hammered, you know, aside from, I think, one ODI at the start. It's not that you get the sense of a team that doesn't care. It's just a team that's able to put things perhaps into a more reasonable perspective.
Yeah, and you do see the kind of genuine joy. When, for instance, Chris Lewis scores his one and only Test century, you see the genuine joy in the changing room for him, even though, you know, it's very much written on the wall that it's in a losing cause. There is a kind of sense of, you know, camaraderie and bonhomie around the touring party, which is reflected at the very end of the film when someone, I can't remember who it is, says, you know, the curious thing was, for a tour that kind of went wrong at every stage, they had matches that were, you know, postponed because there were riots happening in certain cities and there was a strike happening for one of the airlines. So they had to go on this, you know, a number of sort of 16-hour train journeys back and forth across the country to play games. You know, it was kind of a logistical nightmare. As my wife said, kind of watching it over my shoulders, it looked like a kind of bad gap year. Despite all of that, despite them getting, you know, sort of viral infections and things like that, there's this reflection that there were no arguments that were had amongst the team, that everyone was kind of glad to be there and glad to be having, you know, the experience and kind of getting on with it. And also at no point do we see anyone kind of complaining about, oh, this is what touring in India is like and isn't it, you know, and isn't it awful? And I think that's a kind of, yeah, remarkable reflection on the kind of spirit in which they approach that tour.
I mean, part of the argument, if it is trying to make an argument that the film tries to make, is that this is the end of an era, right? And that we very quickly moved into more professionalized tours. There's always the danger in cricket, as with anything, of excessive nostalgia. But there is a part of me that thought it's just great to see these young men like having fun and enjoying it, looking back with fondness. And, you know, there's a part of me that wonders if our current generation, not just of England players, but actually of other test sides, you know, if you ask them in 20, 30 years about a tour, they'd probably tell you about, oh, it was fantastic, that win we got here. Would they look back on the tour as a whole with this fondness in the way that these players do? Yep. Sadly, I doubt they would.
Well, there was that interesting article that was written by, I can't remember who it was, but a couple of years ago, and it kind of coincided with the test, that series on the Australian team being released, which kind of said that, you know, these young cricketers nowadays, mm-hmm. God, I sound like I don't know what, but you know, some of the most well-travelled people of their generation, and yet, so they've been to India, but they've never seen the Taj Mahal, because actually all that happens is people play video games in their hotel rooms. Whereas what you see in this documentary is the players just desperately having to try to find ways to make their own fun. So for instance, there is the kind of debutants show where, you know, if it's your first tour, you have to, you know, put on this kind of slapstick comedy charade. So you have someone dressed up as, you know, Gats with a, you know, pillow stuffed up your top, and, you know, doing impersonations of your, this kind of variety show they put together. There's also the creme caramel eating competition. And yeah, exactly, it is just kind of a whole load of young guys sort of just having fun together.
For that alone, if you want to know how you can eat a single creme caramel in one gulp, it's worth watching this. And
it's astonishing. It's astonishing.
I think we probably do have to acknowledge that maybe there's an aspect that tougher things, harder feelings were being repressed here. I mean, I think it's fascinating that amongst all the current conversations that we're having about mental health in sport, you hear Graham Gooch in one of the episodes completely deadpan describing his divorce as not a good starting point for a tour, which I imagine, you know, at certain cricket fans would greet that with impressed as to his resilience, and I think others would say that's is a slightly concerning attitude. In terms of the cricket, because we probably should say a little bit about the cricket, you feel that for an India side, this feels like a birth of something very exciting. We see Tendulkar's first Test century in India. We see Anil Kumble's breakthrough series. It's funny, yes. He's a player I've not thought about for a while, and it was quite remarkable here. So while we're seeing these talents born on the Indian side, the sort of talents that kind of briefly flared on the England side, as you've said, Chris Lewis's wonderful lone Test century, this defiant effort in defeat, and there's Graham Hicks' first Test 100. And I think there is something a little bit poignant about watching those on the basis that neither go on to achieve what they really would have hoped to have.
And Ian Salisbury as well, getting his call up to bowl in a bowl in the first test despite being the net bowler on the tour. So he gets called up over the head of Tufnell and Ambury, and we know that he is the great lost English leg spin talent. It does become this kind of narrative of English failed opportunity, whilst this great new Indian generation is kind of burgeoning. The other thing that you kind of realise, this goes back a little bit to John Woodcock's grandfather and the nature of time, but the other thing you realise is that you see this fresh-faced Tendulkar, and you realise Tendulkar only retired, however many, not very many years ago. And suddenly you realise what a span of time, because you watch this documentary and you feel like it's absolutely ancient history, and all of these players we now know as kind of, slightly geriatric commentators. But Tendulkar is someone who managed to span an incredible development of Indian cricket from a kind of age of, amateurism through to the IPL. He was the kind of thread that went through that whole time in quite a remarkable way.
I was struck by how idolised he was so early on. I think not having really been at an age where I could follow cricket at that point, I'd always sort of thought the Indian public's love for him sort of grew as he grew. But actually, we see him here as a young talent, and God, the fans are clearly very much on board.
And you see some of the, even to some of the brief excerpts of him batting, and he does as someone, I can't remember who it is, makes the point, you just look at him at that age and you just see a single shot and you go, oh my God, he is good. So that is Spinwash 93, a Sky Sports documentary on the 1993 disastrous England tour of India. It's available on YouTube, 3 20 minute episodes. I think it comes highly recommended by both of us. And that was the 142nd episode of Reverse Swept Radio.